Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau. Several months ago, it was my pleasure to interview in this studio the best-selling author, Iris Chang, on two of her books, The Rape of Nanking and The Chinese in America. On November 12, 2004, Iris Chang was found dead in her car of a self-inflicted gunshot. She was 36. This week, we offer our conversation about The Rape of Nanking. Next week, we'll air the second part of that interview on The Chinese in America. Also joining us will be Talking History's Fiona Beatty, who will provide us with some leads on where we can learn more about the Nanking or Nanjing massacre, and Jeffrey Kimball, who will look into the influence the anti-war movement had on the conduct of the Vietnam War. But first, let's take a look at an item of historical interest in the news. From time to time, various preservation groups publish what they consider to be the most threatened historical sites of particular interest to them. Well, a new list is out, provided by the Civil War Preservation Trust. It lists the most threatened Civil War battlefields. Here are the top 10 from that list, all of which are threatened by some form of commercial or housing development. Chancellorsville, Virginia, where between April 30th and May 6th, 1863, Robert E. Lee defeated Joseph Hooker, but also where Stonewall Jackson was mortally wounded. Fort Donelson, Tennessee, where between February 11th and 16th, 1862, General Ulysses Grant defeated and took as prisoners some 15,000 Confederates. Franklin, Tennessee, where on November 30, 1864, Confederate General John Hood ordered a disastrous assault on Union earthworks, resulting in the loss of 6,000 men. Glendale, Virginia, where on June 30, 1862, Robert E. Lee nearly broke through Union lines during his retreat from the Battle of Malvern Hill. The Hell Hole, Georgia, where between May 25th and June 1st, 1864, Joseph E. Johnson made one last desperate but failed attempt to halt General William T. Sherman's advance on Atlanta. Mansfield, Louisiana, where on April 8, 1864, General Richard Taylor's victory over Union forces secured the Red River Valley for the Confederacy. Morris Island, South Carolina, which between July 10th and September 7th, 1863, was the scene of the assault on Fort Wagner by the 54th Massachusetts, an African-American regiment made famous in the movie Glory. New Bern, North Carolina, where on March 14, 1862, Union troops seized the strategic port and rail hub. South Mountain, Maryland, where on September 14, 1862, Confederates slowed General George McClellan's advance against Robert E. Lee 2 days before the two armies clashed at Antietam. And Wilson's Creek, Missouri, where on August 10, 1861, the first major battle west of the Mississippi and a Confederate victory was fought. Yet to come, Iris Chang on the Rape of Nanking, Fiona Beatty with another of her sites of the week, and Jeffrey Kimball on the Vietnam anti-war movement. You're listening to Talking History. The interview you're about to hear was conducted before the death of Iris Chang this past November. She was in our studio at radio station KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. Joining us in our studio today is best-selling author Iris Chang. This week and next, we'll be discussing two of her books, The Rape of Nanking, published in 1997, and The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, recently published by Penguin Books. Iris has a journalism degree from the University of Illinois, and after working as a reporter in Chicago, she won a graduate fellowship to the writing seminar program at Johns Hopkins University and turned to writing full-time. She's been the recipient of the John T. and Catherine D. MacArthur Foundation's Program on Peace and International Cooperation Award, as well as major grants from the National Science Foundation, the Pacific Cultural Foundation, and the Harry S. Truman Library. Welcome, Iris.
Thank you.
You have an unusual situation here, a bestseller, made headlines both in academic journals and in the popular press. Why do you think that was the case?
I think it's in part because of the rampant denials of this massacre by Japanese ultranationalists and even Japanese government officials, that this had ever happened at all. And that's what keeps the issue alive. And I also believe that most Americans were genuinely shocked when they learned about the rape of Nanking for the first time.
Okay, I want to come back to both of those points, denial and the fact that such a huge event could be unknown. But first, how'd you come upon the story then?
It's part of my family legacy. My parents told me when I was a little girl that my grandparents had barely escaped the massacre. And as a child, I tried to find details about the massacre in my local school library, but couldn't find any books on the subject. So only later as an adult did I start my search in earnest.
Okay. The story begins really properly in 1937 with the taking of Nanking. But you need to set us up a bit. What was going on in Asia in the 30s that leads up to this?
Well, in 1931, Japan occupied Manchuria and installed Puyi, the last emperor of China, as the puppet leader. Before that time, Japan had been suffering from a severe economic depression and began to see the conquest of China as the answer, as the solution to their economic woes. And tensions soon escalated between China and Japan, and it led to a full-scale invasion of China by Japan in the summer of 1937. And the Japanese attacked the city of Shanghai and expected to conquer all of China within 3 months. Unfortunately for them, the invasion of the city of Shanghai alone took that long, and the fighting soon disintegrated into pretty much battles in the streets.
I think this is important prologue, and you were wise to put it in your book, especially Americans only tend to see the war starting on December 7th, and yet it's been going on for years, and you can either call it prologue or first stages of the war, but war is raging in Asia leading up to this. So tell us about then the taking of Nanking itself. How did it happen and what went on?
Then in December 13th, 1937, the Japanese Imperial Army invaded the capital city of China, which was then the city of Nanking. And within just a matter of weeks, they raped, tortured, and murdered hundreds of thousands of people. An estimated 300,000 Chinese civilians were killed, and an estimated 20,000 to 80,000 Chinese women were raped. That was then the single greatest mass rape in world history. And the Japanese also turned murder into sport in that city, bayoneting babies, even ripping fetuses out of the bellies of pregnant women. It was truly one of the great horrors of the 20th century.
Yeah, and you cover it very well. Speaking of coverage, although there is some narrative in there, you take a rather interesting approach of looking at it really from three different perspectives, the Japanese, the Chinese, and then a group of Westerners. First of all, why did you choose this approach rather than just giving us a narrative overview?
Well, I was inspired by the approach of the seminal film The Rashomon, in which the story of a rape and a murder is told from the perspective of the rape victim, the murdered husband, the bandit who committed these crimes, and an outside observer. And I realized that different groups would perceive reality differently, even though it's the same story. And that's why I found it very compelling to describe the event from the perspective of the perpetrators, the victims, and from the outside observers, the Western missionaries and professors and diplomats were in the city at the time.
Okay, so what's the Japanese perspective?
Well, the Japanese perspective was that Nanking was a city in which they would wreak revenge for their fallen comrades in Shanghai. And I think what's very frightening about understanding the Japanese perspective is that we realize that any human being can be systematically trained and desensitized to commit mass murder. Many of the people who committed these atrocities later, when they returned to Japan, led very honorable lives.
Okay, so it's more than just conquest in this case. There is a revenge factor.
A revenge factor, and also the factor of desensitizing the Japanese soldier to mass murder. In other words, they were trained through bayonet practice on live Chinese prisoners and killing contests to see this as just routine.
Okay, let's look at the victims, the Chinese. What's the perspective there?
Well, this perspective involves, of course, helplessly watching your family members be sliced apart in front of you and raped. And what's interesting about the Chinese perspective is that you can see how easy it is for people to surrender their power. And great power comes from the most unexpected sources. One of the most courageous individuals who survived the rape of Nanking was a pregnant teenager who fought three Japanese soldiers who tried to rape her and suffered, I think, at least 37 bayonet wounds and lost her baby, but still survives today. She's a woman in her 80s, and she has many grandchildren. But she was a fighter at heart, even though she should have been perhaps one of the most defenseless victims. But then you also saw other people who surrendered their authority, even though they had the power, such as the Chinese general who fled the city and left it in chaos.
Now, as we turn to the Western perspective, you bring in another very interesting twist here, a Nazi who becomes a hero. So tell us about that.
Well, I was absolutely astonished to find in the course of my research that the leader of the local Nazi party and a German businessman was actually one of the great heroes of Nanking. John Rabe was a businessman for the Siemens Company, and he was also head of the local Nazi party, although at the time he didn't realize what was the reality of the Nazi party in Germany. He saw it mainly as a socialist party. And he not only kept diaries, which his family saved and later shared with me, but tried to stop some of the atrocities physically by inserting himself between the Japanese soldiers and the bodies of the victims. He was also one of the leaders of the International Safety Zone Committee, which created a special sanctuary for Chinese refugees in the city.
Did you ever determine why he did this? You know, what were his motivations in trying to protect the Chinese? Was it just humanity, or were there political reasons? Why did he do this?
No, I think he was a true idealist. In fact, after he returned to Germany, he tried to alert Hitler about the atrocities, thinking he would have a sympathetic audience. Of course, that led to his arrest by the Gestapo. So I think it was a combination of being naive and also being genuinely interested in helping the Chinese people.
Okay. The subtitle of your book is The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II, and I want to pick up on two of the phrases there. First, let's look at the phrase Holocaust. One of the common concerns voice nowadays is everyone wants to use the term Holocaust to amplify or perhaps to emphasize a tragic moment in history. I think you made the point earlier, but let's emphasize that this in fact merits the word Holocaust. Would you speak to that for a moment?
Well, I do think that the rape of Nanking really did represent one of the worst atrocities and genocidal acts of the 20th century, because it was one of the worst episodes of a war that would kill 19 to 35 million Chinese people during 8 years of war. And it definitely reflects a system of brutality that targeted even the most young and defenseless victims.
Brutality, but again, a common question asked whenever we do run across something that qualifies as a Holocaust. How can a people do this? What's the cultural setting other than the revenge factor you mentioned earlier? I mean, revenge alone probably wouldn't lead to that level of devastation. How do you explain it from your research?
I think any race or religion or culture is capable of committing these kinds of atrocities. I don't think it's unique to the Japanese people. And I believe if the right conditions are in place, human beings are capable of unleashing that capacity for mass murder that lies within us all. And I think that the only real hope that we have to prevent these kinds of atrocities from happening in the future is to teach future generations the lessons of history.
Okay, and let me use that as a bridge, because the other key word in your subtitle is forgotten. How could this be forgotten, such a huge event?
I was very disappointed to see that it was indeed forgotten by popular culture. You don't see popular novels or feature films addressing this issue, despite the magnitude of the horror, despite the fact that up to 35 million Chinese people died during this invasion and millions more across Asia. There were many other atrocities that the Japanese Imperial Army committed, including the comfort women system of sexual slavery, where hundreds of thousands of women were used as military prostitutes. Only one in four of them survived. And that medical experiments were also conducted against live prisoners of war in secret laboratories like Unit 731 in Manchuria. But many people still have no idea why and how it happened. And I think that owes itself to several factors, one of which is that this country, because of its demographics, is still one that tends to have a Eurocentric viewpoint of history, because most people have a European rather than Asian heritage. That, of course, will be changing over time with the more recent patterns of immigration. But there were also active attempts by the Japanese government to deny that this had ever happened in the first place. It's a sad but tragic and true fact that the Japanese Ministry of Education continues to censor school textbooks on the issue and reducing the Rape of Nanking to what they call an incident, and whitewashing other war crimes so that the younger generations of school children will not learn of this event.
It seems to me, anyway, that your book put this back on the radar scope in the United States. I mean, there was quite a following, even, as I said, in the popular press. So you really did open things up. I don't know if it's continuing. I guess I could ask you to comment whether you think this is stuck and whether the popular culture is dealing with it in the United States. But you mentioned that the Japanese are still not dealing with it well. Is that still your opinion?
Yes, and it's actually creating problems still in Sino-Japanese relations. For example, the Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi continues to visit the Yasukuni Shrine, where Class A Japanese war criminals are being worshipped as gods. I mean, this is like the moral equivalent of moving statues of Hitler and his cronies into the biggest cathedral in Berlin and having German heads of state pay their respects. But these visits have recently led to China's decision not to grant Japan a bid for its high-speed rail project in China. And I think just the other day, there has been news that within Japan that Koizumi's visits to the Yasukuni Shrine has been seen as a violation of the post-war constitution, which mandates the separation of church and state.
Interesting. I guess we can't predict where this is going to go, but we certainly thank you for your book and opening up this topic and making it a topic with which more Americans are certainly more familiar at this point. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Right. You've been listening to Iris Chang, the author of The Rape of Nanking, The Forgotten Holocaust of World War II. Join us next week when we'll be discussing Iris's most recent book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History. This is Talking History. her site of the week, Talking History's Fiona Beatty tells us of her discovery of a virtual and a real site dedicated to the Nanking or Nanjing massacre, about which Iris Chang wrote.
Let the victims of the massacre be remembered, but not buried in lies. These words proclaim the intentions of the creators of the Nanjing website and World Wide Web Virtual Memorial Hall to the victims of the Nanjing Massacre 1937-1938. The reality is grim, and viewer beware. The photos in the exhibition and movie area are graphic and disturbing. But there is more to it, including links to an excellent document collection in the reading room area, the diaries kept by Minnie Vautrin and John Rabe, members of the International Safety Zone Committee during the rape of Nanjing, eyewitness accounts, information on the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal, and a directory of related sites. When I visited the site, not all of the links worked, but there was still plenty of material to read and discover. As Archbishop Desmond Tutu states in his foreword to The Rape of Nanking, An Undeniable History in Photographs, however graphic the horrors of that dreadful time, I believe it to be an instrument of reconciliation. It is a step on the road to a better world. To find out more about the virtual site and the actual memorial hall, type Nanjing Massacre Memorial Hall in a Google search and click on the link with www.arts.cuhk.edu.
And finally, for our commentary of the week, Jeffrey Kimball offers us his thoughts on the Vietnam anti-war movement and its influence on the conduct of the war. Kimball is a professor of history at Miami University of Ohio.
During the Vietnam War, hawkish Americans accused the anti-war movement of emboldening America's enemies and figuratively stabbing U.S. armed forces in the back. But based on polling data and recently declassified documents, this charge turns out to have no merit. By early 1968, the majority of all Americans were turning against the continued prosecution of the war. They favored gradual withdrawal, Vietnamization, negotiations, and a bombing pause. Support for the war was slipping, even among government officials, the business community, and Democratic and Republican Party leaders. Anti-war activists represented only the tip of the iceberg of this growing discontent. The costs and frustrations of the Vietnam War drove public opinion. Mounting casualties, economic burdens, and social discord were the most palpable. More to the point, the anti-war movement's influence upon communist attitudes was minimal. Even before U.S. intervention and the rise of the anti-war movement, communist Vietnamese policymakers had correctly foreseen that the American people would come to believe that it was not in their interest to endure heavy costs and suffer high casualties in a distant, protracted war for unclear, abstract purposes. To communist leaders, public opinion in Vietnam was much more important than public opinion in the United States. They were realistic enough to know that the outcome of the war would be decided on the military and political battlefronts in Vietnam. After coming to power in 1969, President Richard Nixon, along with his aide Henry Kissinger, slowly came to understand that the war could not be won militarily without even greater losses and costs. By the year 1972, they finally accepted the fact that the war was deadlocked. They had come to appreciate the military and political realities on the ground in Vietnam. They had at last decided to compromise with the other side to bring about a ceasefire. Nonetheless, Nixon and Kissinger, like other hawks, publicly blamed anti-war activists, liberal intellectuals, the press, and Congress for opposing their policies, encouraging the enemy, prolonging the war, and ultimately causing the collapse of South Vietnam. This charge was misleading and false. Morally and ethically motivated anti-war critics of such wars, whether the Vietnam War of decades ago or the Iraq War of today, provide the larger public with alternatives to hardened government positions. These alternatives serve much more to point an honorable way out of the quagmire of perpetual war than they serve to encourage America's enemies. Enemies, after all, are motivated and encouraged by their own resentments and goals and their own interpretations of their prospects. Honest dissent is an important function of a wise and healthy democracy.
You've been listening to Jeffrey Kimball, professor of history at Miami University of Ohio and the author of Nixon's Vietnam War and To Reason Why, the Debate About the Causes of American Involvement in the Vietnam War. Kimball's commentary was recorded courtesy of radio station WMUB in Oxford, Ohio. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona B. D. Producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeVeau.